Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this edition of National Bugle Radio. And today with me, I have Professor Richard Sloan, and we are going to have a conversation about Hollywood values and some other trends that are going on today. Professor Sloan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and hello, National Bugleteers.
Okay. All right. So, we're going to base our conversation around a TV show and a movie. What are we doing? We're doing Imperium, which is a movie with Daniel Radcliffe, former Harry Potter star.
Yep.
And then Man in a High Castle, which is a TV series. Do you know which network it's on?
I don't know which network it's on. It was produced by Amazon, and there was some swearing in it, so I assume it was for cable television.
Okay.
But we live in sort of a box set society now. A lot of people catch up on TV series without actually watching them on TV anymore.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, which one would you like to start with?
Why don't we start with Man in the High Castle, because you and I before have talked about how Hollywood values and Hollywood stereotypes sort of seep into the media product. And Man in the High Castle is a case of, at least from the episode that I watched, is a case of those values seeping in as one might expect, where with Imperium, there are some unlikely turns. There's one or two unlikely turns. I don't want your audience to think that it's too much of a departure from standard Hollywood fare, but it's a little different from what one might expect, whereas Man in the High Castle is exactly what you'd expect.
Okay, well, so let's start with Man in the High Castle.
Okay, well, I'll be honest, I only saw the first episode. Your listeners may be further along in the series, and later episodes may have changed the direction the story goes into and invalidate some of my points. But from my viewing of the first episode, there was a lot more Nazis and Nazism in the story than there ever was in the Philip K. Dick novel.
No, did you read the Philip K. Dick novel?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I read it. It's a very good book. After World War II, of course, America won and Japan lost, and there was an occupation for a time. Americans were in Tokyo, and Americans helped the Japanese write their constitution, and the Americans in Tokyo in the late 40s and early 50s would have sort of looked down on the Japanese. This is something that Philip K. Dick would have been aware of. He wrote the book, I think, in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship between the Americans who were in Japan after the end of World War II and the Japanese, it was not an antagonistic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They were friendly to one another, but, you know, the Americans would kind of like pat the cute Japanese on the head and buy trinkets from them and
mm-hmm.
have them explain a little bit about their cute culture.
Yeah.
But there was a certain looking down on them because they'd lost the war and the Americans had won.
A certain looking down. Yeah, I know a lot of World War II vets. I know a lot of people who had been in occupation force in Japan, and they have fond memories, and for the most part. And, of course, if you were to talk to, in future decades, if you talk to Iraqi occupation veterans, I doubt they'd have the same kind of fond memories.
Yes.
So a very different kind of relationship. I believe the formal occupation ended in 1951, and then in around 1960, the current arrangement with a mutual defense treaty came about, and so you still have military bases in Japan, and some people might want to call it occupation, but it's not official occupation. And the troops, in large part because of the strong yen, if you went 35 years ago, you would see troops walking around Tokyo at night, going to bars and stuff, and it's become increasingly rare because the troops can't afford it. They can't stray that far from their bases. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to interject that background.
No, all interesting. Fills it out. So as I was saying, what Philip K. Dick did is he thought it would be informative and give the reader some insight into, I guess, human nature if he were to flip it around. So he envisioned a occupation in America at the end of a World War II that the Axis powers won. And he envisioned an America that was occupied on the East Coast by the Germans and on the West Coast by the Japanese. The book skips around from different characters, so he shows us several pages in the life of Caucasian Americans living under Japanese occupation and having to sort of be subservient to the Japanese. And, you know, the Japanese would come in and buy the trinkets and pat the Americans on the head. So he flipped it around that way and gave readers a chance to sort of see themselves and see the psychology when it was reversed. And so it was a very interesting book. But Philip K. Dick, he set the book mostly in the San Francisco area. Like I say, it skipped around. I think there were a couple chapters that took place in Colorado. But I don't recall any of it taking place in what would have been the Nazi-occupied part of America.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you never even saw this Amazon-produced series, but you only saw the poster for it, you would have noticed that the key art was a big Nazi flag in Times Square. And if you watched the first episode, which I did, you would have seen swastikas everywhere. Like when people are watching television shows, when they sign on and sign off, they sign off with a swastika. The police all have swastika armbands. They have a couple is watching TV, and there's a mock, I guess, like a What's My Line type show.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Caucasian man who's, they're having to guess what his line is, and he's like a soldier, and he's bragging that he joined the Hitler Youth when he was 15 or whatever. So it's so much about the Nazis, even though that was just sort of the background or the setup of the Philip K. Dick novel, but we didn't actually see the Nazis in the Philip K. Dick novel, which I thought was interesting.
So of this first episode of the first series, how much of it took place in the Japanese Pacific States is I think what they call it.
50% or a little less, maybe around somewhere between 40% and 50%. It was a 1 hour with the commercials cut out, I guess 52 minutes or so, first episode that I watched. And it began in New York with a member of the resistance, you know, the underground resistance, and he was going to drive some special cargo that was going to help his allies to the other side of the United States. And there were Nazis all around, and the people that sent him out on his truck drive, just as his truck was taking off, the Nazis show up and shoot him down. And there is some that took place in the Pacific part of the United States, too. But I was very impressed that the depiction of the Japanese was so kind. If you'd have read the Philip K. Dick novel, the antagonists were the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
The main characters were struggling to survive in a Japan-occupied world, whereas there are several Japanese characters that are sympathetic, and there are very few German characters that were sympathetic. Maybe like the only one I can think of, and I'll tell you this scene because it sort of illustrates how hard the Germans were hit in this and how the Japanese sort of got away scot-free, is there's like a almost medieval torture chamber. When the Nazis are trying to find out who this resistance guy that was driving the truck across the United States was, they caught one of his operatives still in New York, and they had him like tied at the wrists. The top part of his body was stripped, and one guy was beating him with a whip, and then another guy took a bat to him. And it was like, you know, a medieval torture chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And the one sympathetic German character that I remember in the whole thing is the guy who's being tortured passes out. And so the person who's supposed to be flogging him stops flogging him. And the commander comes in and says, why did you stop flogging him? Well, he's passed out. He's not going to give us any information. What is your job? Your job is not to stop. Your job is to beat until he gives the answers. Has he given the answers? Well, no. Then continue to beat him. And then as that German commandant is walking out, one of his underlings says, you're so clever, sir. You already know the answer. Yes, but when he dies from being tortured, the resistance won't know that we know the answer. So the Germans are just cruel sadists throughout. And I thought that would be interesting to talk about on your podcast because it's an example of Hollywood never missing an opportunity to slander the Germans.
Okay. Well, yeah. Now, of course, if they had, you know, made the Japanese look bad, that would just be racist. I want to ask a few other kind of side questions, background questions. So in the novel that took place in the Japanese Pacific States, I suppose mostly, was it more in San Francisco or Los Angeles or where?
San Francisco. Philip K. Dick is from that area.
Okay. So how was the economy of San Francisco? Was it considerably poorer in the novel? Did you get an impression of that? It sounded like really run down, or how was the economy?
Oh, it's so hard to judge because they're different media. One imagines things when reading a novel and then one sees it when looking at it on the screen. But if I had to guess, I'd say the economy was better in the novel than it was on the screen.
Okay. So on the screen, and the screen also to the extent it took place in the Japanese Pacific States, it was also in the San Francisco area.
Yes.
And So how did it portray San Francisco? Was it still like a lot of nice skyscrapers, and did it still look nice, or did it look kind of Blade Runner Detroit-esque?
It wasn't really Blade Runner Detroit-esque. It was a mixture of, you know, there weren't a lot, I don't think there were a lot of skyscrapers in the late 40s or early 50s, which is about where this took place. I'm not sure the exact year.
So it took place decades ago then.
Yes.
Okay.
So it was the nice-looking San Francisco, but Chinatown was everywhere. But it wasn't Chinatown, it was Japan. But it looked to me a lot like, you know, the San Francisco Chinatown had just taken over the city.
Okay. I said Blade Runner Detroit-esque. I guess RoboCop was Detroit. I don't know where Blade Runner took place. Okay. Then as for in the movie...
Blade Runner, just to throw it in, is based on a Philip K. Dick story as well.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay, there you go. So... And then in the TV series, where when they're showing New York, I guess, but this is all supposed to be in, say, around 1950 or so?
There's yes.
Okay. I was wondering, you know, I'm curious. I thought maybe that they had let a few decades go by. I wanted to see what the occupation forces' immigration policies had been. It'd be interesting.
Oh, I see.
That's what I was getting at, was when they show these territories that had been occupied, how had they portrayed its economic development? I wouldn't think that they would have the evil Nazis allowing for massive immigration from the Third World, you know, so what would it look like? But this is still 1950 or so.
Right, but, well, the Japanese, of course, are not really the Third World, but...
The Japanese are not, but, yeah.
A point that I was going to get to is there's a scene where you're in Washington, D.C., and there's a meeting, I can't remember where we were, I guess it was the German embassy. The German embassy now in Washington, D.C., and there's a meeting with the high-ranking German officials and the high-ranking Japanese officials, and the German officials are kind of mean, and they have their meeting, and then they separate, and the German officials are kind of like belittling the Japanese as the Japanese walk away, and then the Japanese say something to each other in the elevator, and you get the sense that they're the victim, and the plot point that they're setting up is Hitler is sick, and he's probably going to die in 6 months. And Goebbels is going to take over. And when Goebbels takes over, he's just going to bomb the West Coast off the map and get rid of all those Japanese.
Huh. Okay. You know, it's not as if either country during World War II actually had occupying America and annexing parts of it as in parts of its strategy. But so that's kind of a Hollywood fantasy. Now, here's another question I have. You know, after the Civil War, the North did use the black population of the South as kind of surrogates for its occupied governments. You know, the North occupied the South, and different states took different numbers of years to be readmitted to the Union. And, you know, during the occupation phase and even after states had been readmitted for a few years, you had this period where states often had black governors or black senators. And... You know, you see this not just after the Civil War, but in other areas. You know, in World War II, you know, one side or the other would set up puppet states. And, you know, they would play one ethnic group off the other. Was there any evidence of that? For instance, like when they were in Washington, D.C., how did they portray, for instance, in Nazi-occupied Eastern America, how were they portraying the situation of blacks? Did they make the Nazis look extremely evil towards the blacks and more benevolent towards whites? Was there any portrayal of that?
I saw a few blacks in the western part of the United States, like, you know, riding on a bus, or there was a black server in a cafeteria.
And that was in the West?
That was in the West, but I couldn't really compare the East and the West in that first episode that I saw. But I do remember in the Philip K. Dick novel, he actually had a hierarchy. And the blacks were sort of at the bottom of the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a hierarchy of who stood where in this new post-war America in which the Axis powers had won.
And who stood where, do you remember?
Well, the Jews were at the bottom because they were non-existent. The Jews had all been killed. And in this first episode of Man in the High Castle, they actually have a guy whose dirty little secret is his grandfather was a Jew, so the Nazis are, better not let the Nazis find that out or you're dead. And then above the Jews were the blacks, and then I guess would have been the whites, and then, you know, above them would the American whites, and then above them would have been the Japanese, and on top would have been the Germans. Maybe it was the other way around, or maybe the Germans and the Japanese were tied, but they were both at the top because they'd won the war.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I just wanted to say one thing, because you were talking about the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also aware of a book that is similar to Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, where it imagines an alternate ending for a different war. There was a book I read ages ago called Bring the Jubilee, and this is an alternate history where the South wins the Civil War instead of the North.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens as a result, you may have something to say about this, is traditionally we've been trained to think of the Southerners as the racists and mm-hmm. the Northerners, you know, as the tolerant ones, right? Because the Southerners resisted integration and, you know, you had the civil rights activism all had to happen in the South because the South was so segregated.
Mm-hmm.
But the author of Bring the Jubilee imagined that if the South had won the Civil War, the South would have been rich and the North would have been poor. And in his novel, it's the Northerners that become the racists.
Okay.
Because there aren't enough jobs, and so a hierarchy system evolves, and it's the Northerners that put the blacks down, whereas in the South, naturally, blacks rise and are treated as equals there just because the economy is good.
Huh.
I hope I'm not doing an injustice to Bring the Jubilee. I haven't looked at it in ages, but that's more or less
what
it was.
But in Bring the Jubilee, the South won the war, which would mean that it became its own separate country, and
yes,
then the North
yes.
was a different country, but the North just became a poorer country, and the South became a wealthier country.
And yeah, I forgot to mention that. The North lost its wealth because it lost the South.
The North, okay, lost
so the
South.
The North slipped into poverty because it no longer had the South.
Okay, and the South worked out its race relations, and everything was hunky-dory there.
Yeah, in the book, it just sort of happened naturally. As the South became richer, the racial strife went away.
Okay, that's interesting. The theme of this program is Hollywood values. So how are Hollywood values affecting culture? And would it be fair to say, I mean, I know the publishing industry has a great deal of Jewish influence in it. A lot of publishers are Jewish owned. But the act of writing a novel is a pretty solitary thing, whereas the act of making a movie or even a TV show requires so much labor, so much resources. Do you think it would be fair to say that Hollywood values, and I'm saying Hollywood values almost as a surrogate for Jewish values, but that Hollywood values are going to be reflected much more in movie and TVs than in book literature?
I would think so. I mean, Philip K. Dick wasn't very popular in his time, and he sort of wrote for himself. And he had these visions of where the world was going, and he saw certain problems in society, and he just wanted to tell his stories and wanted to write about them. And he's really only got to the popularity that he enjoys today. You know, so many movies have been made from Philip K. Dick stories. This was all after his death, really.
Hmm.
He died just before Blade Runner was released, and that was really the first big movie that was made from one of his stories. But anyway, so yes, that's the writer being solitary and being able to survive on hot dogs. Philip K. Dick ate a lot of hot dogs, and writing his work and putting down on paper what he believed in. Whereas, as you say, making a TV series and getting it set up, and then once you do get it set up, it's a collaborative medium and you have to work with all these people. But the hardest thing is to get it set up and to bring in the money. And if I were a showrunner, if I had Man in the High Castle as my project and I was trying to get it set up and put on TV, you can bet that I would want to highlight the Nazi aspect of it and make the Nazis the big villains, even though the Nazis didn't play that much of a role in the Philip K. Dick book, just because you know that so much of the money in Hollywood is Jewish.
Yeah, and Nazis sell, and not so much that they sell to the public, but they sell to the producers.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would, if that's where you were going, I would agree with that point.
Yeah, that's where I was going. So what else can we glean from this TV show, Man in the High Castle, and its contrast perhaps with the novel?
Okay, well, another interesting thing, and I kind of touched on this a bit, is it was very kind to the Japanese who were the antagonists of the Philip K. Dick novel. The Japanese were the occupiers in the novel, and the merchants were the Americans who were now, you know, subjugated. It was the Japanese that had the money. And if the white people or the Americans wanted to sell to them, they had to curry favor with their owners or their masters. Whereas for some reason in this production, I saw, you know, bartenders and an herbalist and a server in a restaurant, Japanese people. There were a lot of Japanese people doing the jobs that Asians might do in today's America, but you wouldn't think that Think about the West Coast being occupied. Japan wins a war. They're going to send delegates or big businessmen over to build things. Are they really going to come over and run an herb shop or get jobs tending bar? Wouldn't that be jobs for the Americans who lost the war to be doing in their own country?
Well, especially five years into it. I mean, if you were to compare it to Iraq, how many bartenders did we send over to Iraq?
Yes. So I really did feel like, you know, the modern day Hollywood view of the world warping basically the central premise of Man in the High Castle. And another thing I want to say is, as I said, there were swastikas and Nazi flags all over. Occasionally you had to see a Japanese flag, but they actually reinvented the Japanese flag. It wasn't the, you know, the rising sun flag that the Japanese military used with the red dot in the middle and then red beams coming out from it on all sides. Mm-hmm. They created this new Japanese flag that never existed with a red dot in the middle and then like blue, I think there was like four or five blue beams coming from it.
Yeah, so I'm looking at it on Wikipedia right now. So it's based on that, the rising sun flag, but the beams coming out are blue, and in some places where you would have beams, you've got little stars.
Right.
So I guess it's an idea of trying to take elements from the American flag and stick it into the Japanese flag and merge them.
It could be. I mean, the thought that came into my mind is basically the Nazi flag, and what I mean when I say the rising sun flag is that red sun with the beams coming from it.
Yeah, it was very, very popular among New Wave people in the 1980s. Yeah.
Right, the flag that was used by the Japanese military in the war, not the flag that waves above Japanese embassies today, not the flag that the Japanese use today.
The red circle.
Those flags are really counterparts of one another. They were both flags of the military movements in World War II of those two countries, the German and the Japanese. But what came into my mind is, well, somehow they didn't want to put the rising sun flag up because it might offend Japanese. But it was okay to put the Nazi flag up. So it seemed like it was okay to offend Germans, but not Japanese.
So when the Nazi flag appears on screen, is it the red field with a white circle and then the black swastika in the middle?
Yes, that was the key art that I mentioned that you would have seen on the posters. Mm-hmm. That's the flag that you see in Times Square.
Okay, so you see that in Times Square. Because on the Wikipedia page, they show an American flag with the 13 stripes, but in the field, the blue field where you would see stars, instead there's a swastika.
Yes, I saw that too, and there were swastikas in passports, and there were swastikas like incorporated into everything. And so I guess what they were going for is, oh, what a terrible world, wherever you look, swastikas. It just was an interesting contrast to me that they just went overboard with swastikas. People had them as armbands. The police, when the guy's truck breaks down and a cop comes to his rescue and helps him change his tire, he's, you know, like a good old boy type cop that's somewhere in the Midwest, I guess, but he's got a swastika around his, you know, that's part of the police uniform. Mm-hmm. So swastikas were everywhere, but where they needed a Japanese flag, they couldn't put the actual either the flag that Japan uses today or the flag that Japan used in World War II times, they had to invent their own flag.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, yeah, because that would just be racist.
Exactly.
So, one last question, unless you have other comments to make. Okay. Was there any effort by either of the occupation governments to ethnically cleanse the natives and move their own population in? Were they actually trying to colonize with their own populations? Were they moving massive numbers of Germans or Japanese in to replace the native population?
No, that wasn't in it.
That wasn't in it. Okay.
But I remembered one other thing that you may be interested in. There was an allusion made to the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. When, as I said, the guy's truck broke down and the policeman with the swastika band around his upper arm comes to help him change the tire, and he says, you know, there's not a diner around for 5 miles, but here have this sandwich my wife made, and the guy's eating his sandwich. He notices that there are large bits of ash floating in the air. And he says, what is that? And the cop says, oh, it's from the local hospital. They burn cripples and the mentally ill every Sunday or something like that.
Okay.
So, you know, so it was sort of an allusion, I think, to the idea that the Nazis just ruthlessly killed anybody that wasn't a perfect Aryan.
All right. Well, What about the movie Imperium?
Imperium, I read a lot of positive reviews online about Imperium, but I thought it was kind of a weak film, and I was surprised by that. And I thought the reason it was weak is because there wasn't really the menace there.
Has it been released yet?
It has been released,
okay.
Yes. Quickly, to let your listeners know what the plot is, I won't spoil the ending for you, or I might.
Go ahead and spoil the ending.
The premise is that there's a very intelligent desk analyst working for the FBI, and that's played by Daniel Radcliffe. And he's recruited by this sort of like rogue woman who works the domestic terrorism desk at the FBI. And, you know, everybody's all hungry to find terrorists from Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the Middle Eastern terrorists. Some chemicals have gone missing. And everybody else at the FBI thinks, oh, it's got to be one of these, you know, mad Muslim groups. But she thinks, you know, it could be domestic terrorism. And she recruits the Daniel Radcliffe character to infiltrate some white nationalists or some white supremacists in order to find out if their goal is to get that material and they've got some sort of evil plot to kill a lot of people to start a race war.
Okay. What about this movie? What in it just departs from credibility?
Well, I think the filmmakers tried, perhaps, like as we said when we were talking about Man in the High Castle, film is a collaborative medium, and there would have been a lot of voices in the making of this project. And maybe some people came from a different place, but some people might have said, well, let's make this. The genre, by the way, is a thriller. You're supposed to be worried constantly about whether the Daniel Radcliffe character is going to get found out or not. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps what they were trying to do is they were trying to not make it ridiculous and not have a big 1,000-man army of Ku Klux Klan members that, you know, don't really exist, not be so over the top so that the audience would go, oh, that would never really happen. And I think what they were trying to do, perhaps, or at least some of the minds that put this project together, was go for something more real. And as a result, there's no real menace to the film. There's no real threat. You go through the whole movie and you never see this army of terrible white supremacists about to do some evil thing to the United States. You do see a few. There are three or four people that wind up with some cans of chemicals that I guess they were going to dump into the Washington, D.C. water supply. And Daniel Radcliffe calls the cops in or the FBI in at the last minute and they get foiled. But it almost feels like, well, these are just three weird guys. You know, it's not like there's this big secret army of Nazis, which a lot of people believe that there is, or some conspiracy theorists
yeah.
believe.
Oh, and, you know, yeah, we get treated that way. I say we. We white people get treated as if amongst us there's a massive army of white supremacists who are going to Holocaust the rest of the world.
Well, what I wonder and what I think that, you know, a young person watching this movie might have experienced when watching the movie. Like I say, you get to the end and you're waiting for the big evil James Bond type Blofeld or Dr. No or the big villain to reveal his plot to blow up the world. And it's never really there. You know how the James Bond villain, there's always this like underground lair and it's huge and he's got this whole army and he's got all this technology and it's not there.
And it has some excessively complicated, improbable means of killing James Bond in such a way that he doesn't actually witness the death and then can be surprised later on that James Bond has escaped. Very interesting.
Yeah. So it sort of reminded me of your friend Dr. Duke going on the Alex Jones show, and I don't listen to Alex Jones all that much.
You're not
but missing my
much. My
perception listening to that one interview was that Alex Jones really believed up until that point that there was this, to use Alex Jones's terms, there was this army of globalist Nazis that were, you know, like pulling all the strings. And now he was really going to talk to one. And good old Dr. Duke was going to be good enough to let him in on the secret. And you could just see Alex Jones's face fall when Dr. Duke was making sense. And there wasn't any evil, you know, like white supremacist army out there. And that's sort of where you get with this movie if you watch it till the end. If you're a young person and if you're not a person that goes into it believing that every time you see a swastika, oh, you know, that's this terrible, horrible threat, and that in and of itself means that villainry.
Okay.
That in and of itself implies villainry.
Now, the people who produced the movie and paid for the movie, they weren't trying to make it seem as if the threat of white supremacy is just a hoax. That wasn't their point, was it?
I don't know. See, I can't speak to where they were coming from. My guess is they were going for realism. But the interesting thing about this movie is they went so far to actually, you heard things being said like, they mentioned the term white genocide. There's a point where when the Daniel Radcliffe character has to convince the first group of Aryan thugs that he's on their side and he's legitimate, he talks about the U in the circle that appears on all the food and how certain Jewish rabbis, it's a billion-dollar industry and all food produced in the United States has to be kosher or it's sort of like blackmail. And they talk about a lot of things that the average person wouldn't know about. And I'm sure that people in the white nationalist movement are probably happy that those messages were communicated. And then if the same people that were saying this at the end turned out to be Blofeld or Dr. No, or, we're going to like torture women and cut legs off cats and do something so horrible, it might turn the audience off and you would associate the idea of white genocide with, an evil, sadistic Bond villain who wants to cut the legs off all cats. But it didn't go that way. It wound up basically with three chumps in a garage with a couple buckets of chemicals being arrested by a bunch of FBI agents. So the message got out there. And it wasn't sprayed with repellent.
So, when I watch TV, when I don't watch movies much, but if I'm flying on an airplane, I do. But if I watch TV, I watch the programs, listen to, the radio, especially radio like NPR, or even just watch TV commercials. If you were sitting next to me, you'd just be hearing me this continuous commentary on what I see as subtle or not so subtle brainwashing or just in your face. Just, yesterday listening to NPR, they have numerous stories about, for instance, Georgetown University is going to start giving new preferences to descendants of slaves because 200 years ago the university owned land that had slaves and they sold some of the slaves. And so that means that we have to have preferences for Black Americans. And just how many stories, how many references were there to slavery that I saw yesterday or to some form or another of white atrocities?
Right.
Everything making whites feel bad or, commercials always making the white guy look stupid and, there's some smart Black or non-white or woman looking kind of sideways out of the corner of their eyes at this foolish white guy being, foolishly white. It's just so over the top. Now, this movie Imperium, I saw the trailer, and that's all I've seen. And it's probably all I ever will see. And, the trailer seemed in its way over the top, but the way you're explaining it, I don't know. So what were they trying to achieve? And I see this when we talk about Hollywood values. I mean, a lot of the Hollywood values, a big hunk of what's going on now, is to demoralize white people. Did this play into that at all?
Not so much, but I do want to say, and I've said this in my talks with you before, there's this idea that I don't agree with, that somebody makes a movie or somebody creates a piece of television in order to get some sort of idea across or value across. It's often that seeps in later because, a lot of people collaborate on the project. Like I gave you the example when we had a conversation once of if you were creating a commercial and, there was one guy is trying to print his paper and he walks over to the printer and it doesn't work. And another guy, makes a snide comment. And then the third guy uses the paper or the printer that the company that produces the commercial is trying to sell. And the guy that made the snide comment now sort of pats him on the back. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've got sort of straight guy, and you've got stupid guy, and you've got smart guy. If you were to cast that, what color would straight guy be? What color would stupid guy be? And what color would smart guy be?
Yeah, you can't make a non-white or female the stupid guy,
right?
Unless there's going to be other stupid guys and they're just one of them. But if there's just going to be one stupid guy, it's got to be a white man. Otherwise, it's racist or sexist.
Right. So my point is it's going to come out that way. even if the person that came up with the concept wasn't even thinking of race when they came up with it, you know, in casting or somewhere along the way, just because these are Hollywood values. Earlier you asked me if there's a big difference between somebody sitting in a room and writing a novel and a bunch of people creating a television show. When people create a television show, they want it to go to the next season. They want it to go into syndication. They want to connect with the popular values. And these are the popular values.
Whether the popular values, they're the hegemonic values.
They're the go-to values. They're the values you need to go to if you want to. And it gets back to the money, too. Mm-hmm. They're the values you need to go to if you want to get the money to see your project eventually get greenlit.
And I could say we know where the money's coming from. But what I want to say is that in our everyday lives, we deal with individuals. And it's much easier for us to think about decisions, think about trends as being decided by individuals, because that's kind of what we relate to in our everyday life.
Right.
And, of course, the way I look at a lot of things is, for instance, with the Jewish issue, it's not so much individual behavior, it's group behavior. And group behavior is a lot harder. My producers. So it's not the individual behavior, it's the group behavior. And group behavior is a lot harder to conceptualize because the people that we're dealing with are not the group, it's just an individual. And group behavior, it's just harder to conceptualize. There's, you know, a lot of interactions that can be direct or indirect or tangible or non-tangible between members of the group. There's various mechanisms for how groups set their priorities, which aren't necessarily transparent or tangible. And I think this is why conspiracy theory is so popular, is because conspiracy theory operates on the individual level. So there is a secret government somewhere where individuals come together, or a few string pullers. And then we can just think about that individual as making a decision and then ordering other people to do it. And then, you know, their puppets are basically threatened that, you know, they're going to be killed if they don't follow through on these orders. And on all the steps, it's just individual behavior. It's easy to conceptualize. And, you know, this is Alex Jones. So you got the secret government and, you know, there's secret leaders and it's Henry Kissinger or, you know, George Soros. But there's, you know, this individual. And I think when we're talking about Hollywood values, you know, it'd be easy to just say, okay, well, you got a couple of moguls, a few moguls, a few producers, and it's the Weinstein brothers or Steven Spielberg. And of course, they're very important people. But it may well be that to really understand what's going on, you can't necessarily trace decisions that form the basis of these trends to some individual saying, hey, let's just start making white people look stupid in TV commercials. That it's much more complicated than that. That the way you explained it is people know what they need to do in order to continue earning money in their trade. And it might not be that a directive ever came down, but that they just know. I use the term hegemonic. There's a scholar named Michael Parenti. I don't know if he's a university professor. I know he was educated at Yale. He writes a lot of books. And he's a Marxist, but sometimes Marxists have pretty interesting ideas. And he has this, he talks about hegemonic ideas. I guess he really, he's kind of from the Gramsci tradition, the Italian, what was his name, Anton Gramsci. He was a revolutionary leader in Italy who died in prison in the 1920s. At any rate, an idea becomes hegemonic when it really no longer needs to be enforced. There doesn't even have to be an enforcement mechanism. There's self-censorship. Ideas become hegemonic. And so if these ideas of having to have white people be the stupid one in TV commercials, if it becomes hegemonic, there's no longer a need for a directive. There's no longer a need for enforcement. It's just kind of self-enforced. And I know this has been long-winded, but it may well be that in Hollywood, because, the way I would say it is because Jews have formed a critical mass of the decision makers and a critical mass of the financiers, that their priorities, what they see as being what's good for the Jews, the Jewish interest, that Jewish priorities have become the hegemonic ideas. of Hollywood. And so you have a Hollywood value system, which people just kind of implicitly know they have to work within. Did I make things too complicated? No,
that's it. The only thing I would add is don't forget that this is fluid and it continues to evolve.
It's fluid and continues to evolve.
You always want to be edgy. And so if cast A has 10 players and there's one black guy in it, well, you want to be sort of edgier and you want to be, you know, more contemporary. So you want a black guy and a Hispanic guy, or you want a black guy and a gay guy and a, you know, you, it continues to spiral.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you get
spiraling out of control. Are you at all familiar with what's going on in the, like, the Marvel comic universe, Marvel or whatever the other rival to them is, where you're like, Thor is now a black woman, or at least Thor is a woman, and Captain America is, they wanted to make Captain America black, but there was a pushback, and so they made him a Nazi instead. He's been a secret Nazi all these years. And what is it, like, Plastic Man or whatever? No, the Green Lantern. Is the Green Lantern gay? I mean, they're turning these characters to gay or transgender or black or female. I mean, the idea of a female Thor is just, you know, it's kind of standing on its head, the Nordic god Thor, who is about as masculine as you can get. Are you at all familiar with what's going on?
I'm familiar with that phenomenon, and I think you were right to bring it up right after spiraling out of control, because it is this sort of force that's gaining inertia, and it's going to crash, or it's already crashing. It's like a snowball that's picking up more and more snow, but it's eventually going to, you know, hit a rock and going to burst. These comic books are not enjoyed by nearly the same percentage of the population that the characters that gave birth to them were. You know, everybody used to read Superman. Everybody used to read Batman. Everybody used to read Spider-Man. And people just aren't interested. And there's a point, you know, there are some unique things that Imperium did. But one very typical thing that Imperium did is, I told you that the main character is a sort of FBI desk man. And I told you that there was sort of the rogue agent that nobody respects and is always the outsider who comes and says, let me grab you away from everybody else and let me have you work on domestic terrorism. And that rogue character 30 years ago or 40 years ago would have been a white guy, but he would have been the white guy that didn't wear the tie. You know, that's why he was different from everybody else. Everybody else wore a tie and he didn't, and he did things his way. And 20 years ago, he would have been the black guy, you know, but he knew how to work with the system, but you know, he was his own man, and maybe he didn't wear the tie either. Well, in this, it's a woman. And she just somehow that character, it almost feels like it was written for a man, which it often is. And then in casting, they made the switch and they put a woman there. And it just didn't work because she was like the rogue, tough one that did everything different. And so you couldn't have her be very feminine, but you didn't want her to be ugly. You didn't want her to be a lesbian. And this poor actress, you know, she had to sort of walk the middle ground. And the cliche thing to do would be, he always smokes a cigarette or he always smokes a pipe or something. Well, I guess they decided it would look silly to have a woman do that. And so you see her smoking a cigarette in like the first scene or the second scene when you meet her. And then she says, you know, I got to go back to Nicorette or something like that. And then every scene you see her, she's chewing gum. There's even a scene where they're at a restaurant and they're eating and she's chewing gum. And it's just, it's kind of disgusting, and she doesn't really work as a character. So I'm surprised this movie got such great reviews, because there were some problems in it, and this was just one little thing. It wasn't like, you know, it didn't kill the movie or anything. But this is that same phenomenon of Thor being a woman or Green Lantern being gay, is there's a point somewhere uphill where it's inspired casting. Like, I remember Jesus Christ Superstar, and Judas was black. And he was just so good, and it was just so different and unexpected. But he was great in that role. And there have been, you know, like the early Sidney Poitier movies. There are times when you cast against expectations, and it's really cool and it's really different. But then the snowball keeps gathering momentum, and now, well, you know, the president has to be black. And, well, there has to be a Hispanic somewhere, and somebody has to be gay. And it just gets to where it doesn't work anymore. And it just, it's weird. And, you know, I think that Marvel Comics and, you know, mainstream Hollywood, they're killing their own product with this.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm waiting for. It sounds like they're killing their own product. And you think of the NFL just this year. So at the beginning of this year, you had the Super Bowl, and they have Beyonce celebrating Malcolm X and Black Lives Matter, which Dr. Dukes talked a lot about. I don't know how much of a reaction there was to it. And then they have Colin Kaepernick, who is a famous quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. He's not standing for the national anthem anymore. And then all the famous black athletes from the past and other people are coming to his support. But the fans, for the most part, aren't. And the NFL and professional sports, are they also killing their goose that lays the golden egg? Or not killing the goose so much, but the audience is really the goose that lays the golden egg. The money is coming from the audience. And if they're going to just abuse the audience, at what point are people going to start turning off? And that could happen. I don't know why it hasn't happened already. And then, of course, I don't watch movies or drama TV shows. I do watch news shows. And earlier this month, I was watching a news show, and they were talking about one of these incidents where a black man who had committed crimes and he was running from the police and he pointed his gun at the police and wound up getting shot. He was the cause celebre of demonstrations, and CNN had some black lawyer or law professor on, and they also had a representative of the police union on. And the black lawyer was talking about the criminal who had been shot after pointing his gun at the policeman as being an innocent man. And the spokesman for the police union just could only say something like, well, you're innocent until proven guilty, or something really meek. And that's how far things have gotten, where you have these, you know, real people. We're not talking about fiction. We're not talking about TV commercials or sports. Real instances where you have black criminals pointing their guns at whites, at white or even black police officers getting killed. And then it's like, well, he should have been tased. There was an innocent man. He hadn't shot. Why did you shoot him? And people have got to turn off to this. Well, I guess we'll find out more later this year when the election takes place, how much people are really getting fed up with this. Okay, yeah?
So to get back to Imperium, I think that that could have been a factor in why the movie came out the way it did. Is, you know, Americans like the underdog, sort of, and the white man's struggle is, I think, getting more attractive in the eyes of the public. It's certainly, here's my guess. My guess is people beyond a certain age, older than a certain age, most people who see this movie will empathize with the main character. But younger people who see this movie might think, well, you know, like, I'm not so much on the FBI's side. This movie may actually inspire younger people to look into, you know, what white nationalism is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
a scene just came to mind. There's a scene where the Daniel Radcliffe character is trying to win favor with neo-Nazis. You know, it's a thriller. And so he bounces between, like, skinheads and neo-Nazis and Aryan Nation and Klansmen, and then this, like, Rush Limbaugh slash Alex Jones character and his entourage, to try to find who's behind the plot. And there's this one scene where he's in like a neo-Nazi march, and the police have the road barricaded so that the Nazis could demonstrate, because they presumably have a permit to demonstrate. And the crowd is terrible, and they're throwing things, and they're causing fights. And in that scene, you're really on the Nazi side if you watch that movie.
It sounds like a Trump rally almost. I'm not trying to compare Trump to the Nazis, but the crowd scene.
Yeah, the crowd, you know, there are like the anti-Fas or the liberals who put the masks on and don't show their face because they're going to the rally basically planning on committing a crime. There are people that are masked in that scene, and the neo-Nazis are doing their best to march, and the crowd's picking fights with them.
Well, I mean, you certainly have cases like in the 1970s, the movie Network, which was a completely Jewish creation, and it was portraying the media as being taken over by Arabs. And yep. A lot of people in the know about Jewish role in the media, it's almost a cult favorite with them. So I don't know. I don't know if any of this stuff, it's going to backfire. People are close enough to waking up. Well, we're coming towards the end of the hour. Is there anything you'd like to add or summarize?
Well, a couple quick things. A movie that you might compare Imperium to is an older movie from the 90s called American History X. And American History X is about a white supremacist, you know, and he really wants his white friends to win the basketball game against the blacks. And then he winds up committing crimes, and I think he kills a black guy, and he gets sent to prison. And then his best friend in prison winds up being a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a younger brother that is a sympathetic character, but he's a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's different from having a sympathetic kid and having a sympathetic adult. The point I want to make is in American History X, the only sympathetic characters really are non-white characters. There's the black guy that the white supremacist bonds with in prison, and that sort of turns him away from being a white nationalist, and now he's about we are the world and unity. And then there's his younger brother, who isn't a perfect character because he idolizes his older brother, who's actually committed crimes and killed a guy. And that younger brother is mentored by a teacher that wants to help him, and that teacher is black. And that's very, very typical Hollywood, is the real sympathetic characters in that film were black. Interestingly, by comparison, I can only think of one non-white sympathetic character who's kind of like a peripheral character. But all of the main characters, there's a lot of people in these white movements in the movie Imperium that are sympathetic, that you like. And that was just kind of surprising to me. And reviews I read, nobody bumped on that. There's one thing I want to close with. I want to say one thing really quickly, and then I want to ask you to tell a quick story to set up my last point.
Okay.
The one thing I want to say is that I read a review in Variety of Imperium, and they said that the radio host that our main character in Imperium is going after, who originally they think that he's behind this evil terrorist plot that's going to happen, in Variety they said he was based on Alex Jones. And maybe that's because Alex Jones throws out a lot of conspiracy theories, and it turns out this guy in the movie was all talk, and he wasn't really behind a terrorist plot. He was just throwing out a lot of things. You know, the audience brings what the audience brings when the audience goes to the movies, and movies are different things to different people. Now, very quickly, could I ask you to tell the story of the swastika in the drain, the plumber story?
Okay, yeah, I was having some plumbing work once. I was having a sink installed, I was having a floor installed, and a general contractor came in, and we were trying to think of a pattern for the floor, and this was when I lived in a Jewish neighborhood, and I said, I want to make sure that the pattern we put in can't be interpreted as a swastika anyway, you know, if you look at the pattern in the grout or anything. And he laughed, and he said once he was installing a sink in the same neighborhood, and he installed the sink, and then like the next day the guy called him back, you know, it's a Jewish guy, and he said, there's a swastika in my sink. And he came in, you know, to look at it, and sure enough, if you looked at the sink, you could kind of see the marble pattern, there was some sort of swastika. So he uninstalls the sink, orders a new one, and installs a new sink. And, you know, everything's fine. You know, he installs it, it's done in the afternoon. The next morning, the guy calls him back again. There's a swastika in the sink. And he comes in, and they figured out that the swastika was just the way a light was coming in through the window. And, you know, the window had panes in it, and the wood between the panes was making a swastika type of shadow into the sink. That's the story.
Okay, well, I heard it told a slightly different way, so am I fair?
And the way you remember it is probably more accurate, because you have a better memory for these things than I do.
The way I remember it is, well, you just left out the panicky nature of the guy that kept calling the plumber back. He thought it was some sort of evil plot, and he was really, like, freaked out because he couldn't use his sink now because there was a swastika in it. Is that...
Yeah, your memory for our conversations tends to be better than my memory.
Okay, so my point is, that guy watching Imperium would have been completely with the Daniel Radcliffe character the whole way, because that guy gets freaked out by seeing a swastika in his drain. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that's all this movie had, is it just had swastikas, and it had burning crosses, and it had Ku Klux Klan hoods. And a lot of that was just, it felt to me, you know, as somebody who's seen how film is put together, it felt to me like something that was probably added at the last minute. It probably wasn't in the shooting script. They probably shot it, and they probably thought, oh, we got to put more menace into this. And so there were a couple montages where I think they even showed a picture of David Duke. I could be wrong, but you know, there was like Dylan Roof. You saw a picture of Dylan Roof. You saw, you know, you saw Klansmen burning crosses and things. And this was like, it wasn't something that was happening in the real time of the movie. It was like happening in the Daniel Radcliffe character's mind as he was like surfing the internet and trying to get in the mood and trying to anticipate who he was going to be dealing with. But then when he went to meet these people, they were just kind of like cool people. So my feeling is that your swastika in the drain guy would be so freaked out by that montage and by those horrible symbols that, oh, Daniel Radcliffe has to infiltrate and he has to find out who has the plot and he has to bust those guys. But young kids, you know, young generation, 18, 19, you know, 14 today, they see swastikas everywhere. Their manga characters have swastikas. And it's like that symbol doesn't really have the power in and of itself to communicate danger and threat to people of a certain age. And so I think that's where the divide is going to be on this movie.
Huh. Okay. Well, Professor Sloan, thank you very much for coming on the show again.
Sure.
And we'll have to do this again sometime very soon.
Okay.
Okay. Hey, do you like my theme music on the way out?
Wonderful theme music.
Guess what it is. Guess what it is.
I cannot hear it. What is it?
Not I was there. Just playing along. If you were to guess something, I would put it on.
Why Don't We Do It in the Road by the Beatles.
Okay. Here's why we shouldn't do it in the road. Here's why we shouldn't do it in the road. Here's why we shouldn't do it in the road. Here's why we shouldn't do it. There are so many valid reasons why we shouldn't do it in the road. Reason one. A truck might hit you and explode. Reason two. Oncoming traffic will be slow. Reason three. Oh, British roads are very cold. Reason four. It violates the highway code. Reason five. But the most important reason, your backside will get covered in stones.